Just to apologize in advance, I don't have an interesting sort of presentation or interesting notes. Well, I mean, like a, you know, like a what's it called, PowerPoint thing. So I apologize if I'm adopting a somewhat more old school, perhaps less dynamic approach to the seminar. Just to briefly give you some background, I'm doing, this is drawn from, well, I think it will be the first chapter of my thesis, which is a study on a very important 19th century Gaudiya Vaishnav theologian called Kedarnathdatta Bhaktivinod. The Gaudiya Vaishnav tradition being that tradition that traces its origins into Chaitanya, who was the 16th century Bengali ecstatic Krishna devotee. I guess the overarching sort of problem or question that I'm addressing in doing this study is that of, well, there seems to be a somewhat prevalent conception that everything in the 19th century gets reinvented, or there's a major rupture with everything that comes before the colonial period. So the notion of modern or neo-Hinduism, like the term modern or the prefix neo, doesn't just denote sort of historical distinction, but almost an ontological distinction, which, if you unpack that concept, seems to sort of comprise of ideas of an emerging historicism in that period, expanded notions of dharma and universalism, a new kind of derived Victorian Puritan ethic at that time, and obviously a burgeoning nationalism. These are the sorts of factors that comprise what generally goes by the name neo or modern Hinduism. And what I'm seeking to do in this study is to show how that paradigm doesn't quite fit, the writings of a very significant Gaudiya Vaishnav theologian at the time, and I think his wider community as well. So I'm now going to move on to reading this. It's called Bhaktivinod Thakur's Krishna Sangita, Negotiating History in 19th Century Bengal. The 19th century, century is widely regarded as a pivotal period in South Asian religious history. Colonial presence in the region entailed intense and prolonged exposure to challenging currents of Western modernity for many South Asian religious traditions and practitioners. In addition to sweeping social and institutional transformations affected by the colonial regime, indigenous traditions had to contend with new and manifold challenges to their worldviews in the form of, among other things, early Western Indological scholarship, Christian missionizing, and post-Enlightenment ideas and ideologies disseminated through British-oriented educational curricula. Almost just in time. While religious responses to the colonial challenge varied widely, there is a prevalent belief within scholarship that the encounter with modernity marked a definitive rupture with pre-modern indigenous religious traditions. Torkel Brekker thus writes, "During the 19th century, there took place a complete transformation of Indian religions. Freedom Hardy has similarly spoken of a major discontinuity which arises through the advent of the British colonial power in India from the 18th century. Some, in fact, see this rupture as so far-reaching as to claim that much of what we now recognize as culture was produced by the colonial encounter. Positions such as these derive from a broader theoretical framework that interprets colonialism in India as having extended itself to such a degree as to have not merely exerted dominance over India's social and political realms, but to have attained full-scale hegemony over its epistemic world as well. The colonial transformation of knowledge was, Sudipta Kaviraj argues, an epistemic rupture on the vastest possible scale, one of the greatest known in history. On this account, it was a rupture so vast and so complete as to appear to preclude any form of continuity with what preceded it. Such views have not gone unchallenged, and recent years have witnessed something of a wave of correctives to this overarching post-colonial narrative. Uneasy with this narrative's inherent proclivity to, as Richard Eaton puts it, situate all Indian time in reference to the British imperial period. These revisionist critiques have sought to interrogate pre-British South Asian history in greater depth, particularly the 150 or so years immediately preceding the consolidation of British colonial power that have come to be known as the early modern period. So Richard Easton says that just the very term, or like the very notion of post-coloniality, forces us to deal with time, you know, either as colonial, pre-colonial, or post-colonial, completely sort of prioritizing that moment. Yeah. So, such correctives thus seek to bring to light, as Philip Wagner explains, significant elements of continuity, epistemic and otherwise, running across the presumed colonial divide. Among the most vexed issues within this debate in South Asian intellectual history has been that of history itself, or more precisely, consciousness of history itself and its genesis in South Asia. Historical consciousness is often characterized as one of the key signs of the modern. As Constantin Fasseau explains, the study of history invented by early modern humanists, based on the critical study of primary evidence and perfected by professional historians in the 19th century, constitutes one of the characteristic features of the modern age. The debate pertaining to the Indian context has thus centered on whether history and colonialism arose together, rendering historical consciousness a marker of epistemic rupture, or whether historical consciousness is of earlier, more indigenous origins, the index of an early, non-derivative modernity in South Asia. Characterizations of India as a civilization devoid of a real sense of history have, of course, abounded since at least the days of Hegel, and count James Mill, Marx, Weber, and Iliada among their more well-known advocates. More recently, Vinay Lal has claimed that ahistoricism is one of the defining features of Indian civilization, averring that historiography in anything like the modern Western sense was absent before the colonial period. Rao, Shulman, and Subramaniam, on the other hand, have countered with the claim that there is no dearth of historians in South India during the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, that history is a post-Renaissance Western genre, they argue, can only be sustained by willfully ignoring a vast body of materials available from South Asia. Turning to the Bengali scene, the evident fervor of middle-class Bengalis for all things historical from around the mid-19th century was definitely, in some sense, unique to the period. Educated in British institutions like Hindu College in Calcutta that, in accordance with a vision spelled out in Macaulay's infamous Minute on Education, sought to mould appropriate Bengalis into men Indian in blood and colour, but English in morals and taste and in intellect. And living in the context of a burgeoning nationalism, this significant Bengali social group, commonly referred to as the Bhadralok, i.e. the gentle people or gentlemen, acquired a real sense of urgency for claiming a history of their own. As the prominent 19th century Bengali novelist Bankim Chandra Chattopadhyay anxiously declared in 1880, Bengalis have no history. Historical consciousness even began to surface in religious texts, evinced, for example, by the proliferation of specific dates in mid-19th century Vaishnav writings, displaying a concern for history uncharacteristic of Vaishnav literature prior to that period. Yet, I would like to argue that modern historical consciousness did not seize the Bengali middle-class mind as comprehensively as it is commonly believed to have done. Adopting an approach that I see as a correlate to revisionist early modern approaches that seek out pre-colonial indigenous forms of historical consciousness, in what follows, I attempt to bring to light the forceful persistence in the 19th century of pre-modern forms of what, following Partha Chatterjee, we might call mythical or Puranic history. So I'm thinking, like, if you're trying to establish continuity, there's really two ways of doing that, either sort of examining the you know, earlier origins to something, yeah, that exists in the modern period, or to trace the persistence of something in a later period. And the former route seems to have been taken a bit more, you know, often. But if anyone knows of any examples of that, you know, the sort of second route, please inform me, because I'm looking for them. I will do so by exploring the writings of a pivotal figure within the Gaudiya Vaishnav tradition of Bengal named Kedarnath Dutta Bhaktivinod. The present investigation is thus intended to challenge, albeit modestly, the paradigm of rupture as it is applied to the 19th century Gaudiya Vaishnav tradition. Bhaktivinod was a key religious figure in 19th century Bengal. His devotional and theological writings, editorial and publication projects, and organizational endeavors played a crucially contributive role in the Gaudiya Vaishnav flourishing of the latter part of the century. As eminent Gaudiya Vaishnav scholar Ramakanta Chakraborty has remarked, Vaishnav journalism as well as Gaudiya Vaishnav organization in Bengal really became meaningful under the guidance of a dynamic Vaishnav deputy magistrate named Kedarnath Dutta Bhaktivinod. Furthermore, Bhaktivinod's work has borne fruit in the form of numerous pupillary lineages in India and more recently across the globe, which trace their spiritual heredity through him and thus testify to the substantive contemporary impact of his labors. He thus lays claim to a central place within 19th century Gaudiya Vaishnav history. I should mention here that those lineages find their most dominant form in what was known as the Gaudiya Mat, which is kind of the institution begun by Bhaktivinod's son in the early part of the 20th century, which really was the mother institution of a whole load of other Gaudiya Vaishnav Mats, most notably, and perhaps most well known to all of us here, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, aka the Hare Krishna movement, which we all see around, but yeah. However, there are other, also, I think, smaller I guess you would call communities in West Bengal, and I have a feeling I heard that actually Bhaktivinod also started something in Vrindavan at one point. He had donated to a temple, but I don't know. I have to follow that up. From a sheltered childhood village existence, Bhaktivinod made the polar transition to the rationally surcharged atmosphere of Kolkata's Bhadralok-dominated educational institutions and intellectual coteries, wherein he rubbed shoulders with many of the established and rising personalities of the day. As he ascended through the ranks of the judicial service of the colonial government, he found himself increasingly drawn to traditional Gaudiya Vaishnav practices, and by his final years had embraced the order of a reclusive Vaishnav renunciate, or Babaji. In spite of this evident biographical arc, there has been a pronounced tendency within scholarship to privilege one dimension or moment of Bhaktivinod's thought, which has, broadly speaking, entailed the placing of what I believe to be inordinate emphasis on the Bhadralok and modernizing facets of his theological and religious enterprise. Such an accenting of Bhaktivinod's social location and its implications on the Vaishnavism that he produced and propagated can be situated within a broader post-colonial discourse of rupture, which foregrounds the historical processes of invention and, more specifically, middle classification at play in the shaping of prominent forms of contemporary Hinduism. The overwhelming primacy that has been accorded to Bhaktivinod's Bhadralok habitus appears, however, to preclude a priori the possibility of genuine transformation, a possibility to which I believe we need to remain open if we are to take seriously the very real and significant role religious practice and tradition played in Bhaktivinod's life. As Gavin Flood explains, religion involves processes whereby a practitioner appropriates tradition, allowing herself, her subjectivity, to become transformed by the practices and narrative of tradition. Close reading of Bhaktivinod's writings bears sufficient testimony to this transformational trajectory, and I shall now turn to briefly examine how this plays out in one of his first major Vaishnav works, the Krishna Sangita, in which we find him explicitly attempting to negotiate 19th century Bengal's emerging historical consciousness. The Krishna Sangita was one of Bhaktivinod's earliest major works as a full-fledged Vaishnav author. The overarching Vaishnav agenda of the text is made explicit from its very outset. Quote, "I have composed this book, the Krishna Sangita, in accordance with the genuine purport of the Aryan scriptures, or Shastra. Vaishnav principles, tattva, are the very culmination of Aryan religion." End quote. The text, however, confounds anyone expecting a straightforward exposition of Vaishnav doctrine. As an instance of Gaudiya theologizing, the work is most certainly innovative, as Thomas Herzig and Kenneth Valpy have remarked. It is perhaps primarily because of this that the Krishna Sangeeta has drawn considerably more academic attention than most other works within Bhaktivinoda's expansive textual corpus. Bhaktivinoda's formative years in Calcutta had adequately acquainted him with Western methods of historical critical analysis, and he displays no hesitation in bringing this training to bear in the Krishna Sangeeta. The text begins with a Bengali introduction, Upakramanika, of some 80 pages detailing the emergence and development of Aryan religion in India, grounded on an Orientalist-inspired philological approach, which Bhaktivinoda interchangeably styles the Adunikabad, modern theory, or Adunika Paddhati, modern method. In this section of the text, we find Bhaktivinoda truncating fantastic Puranic time measurements to accord with an historiographical scheme more congenial to 19th century critical sensibilities, re-narrating certain well-known Puranic events stripped of their mythical aura, proffering revised dates for the appearance of key Indian religious ideas in texts, and even going so far as to suggest a tenable alternative to the traditionally sacrosanct self-narrative of the appearance of the Bhagavad Puran, a text that lays claim to a central position within the Gaudiya tradition, as it does within other Vaishnav traditions. Brian Marvin has, in his pioneering Hindu encounter with modernity, provided by far the most comprehensive scholarly treatment of the text. And I should probably add also the most influential in that anyone else who's done work on Bhaktivinoda has more or less accepted what he's had to say without really questioning it. So he's been exceedingly influential in sort of developing our understanding of Bhaktivinoda. And that's why I seek to take issue with him.
Yeah.
Marvin's analysis of the text is focused primarily upon the Krishna Sangeeta's Upakramanika. For Marvin, central to this section is Bhaktivinoda's application of the Adunika Vad, briefly outlined above. He construes the use of the Adunika Vad in this section as Bhaktivinoda's attempt to appease the rational and historical inclinations of a hitherto textually alienated Bhadralok audience. The Adunika Vad is, so Marvin proposes, a genuine advocation of the application of modern methods of critical analysis to sacred texts such as the Bhagavad Puran, restricted to aspects of those texts that belong to the domain of properly rational discourse, namely history, geography, cosmology, etc. Bhaktivinoda apparently saw such methods as useful in developing sound perspective apropos the needs of Bhadralok readers. Marvin perceives Bhaktivinoda's ability to maintain this ostensibly radical position as derivable from an underlying epistemological theory that neatly demarcates knowledge into phenomenal and transcendent domains, enabling him to at once accommodate and restrict the application of modern critical methods vis-à-vis the Bhagavad Puran. Historical critical analysis is perfectly valid so long as it does not attempt to venture into the inviolable realm of spirit, the stage of God's sacred play or lila, the exclusive purview of faith, Shraddha. In sum, Marvin sees the Adunika Vad as Bhaktivinoda's attempt to develop a presentation of the Bhagavad Puran guarding enough of intellectual integrity as to induce members of his Bhadralok target audience to give the Bhagavad Puran a more effectual reading. To read the Krishna Sangeeta along these lines is, I submit, to read it as the expression of a distinctly middle-class modernizing agenda. It was, of course, Immanuel Kant, that pillar of modern thought, who, intent on circumscribing the application of speculative reason within the realm of objects of possible experience, famously advocated an epistemological distinction between that which can be known by reason, the phenomena, under which we might subsume the category of history, and that which must forever remain beyond its reach, the noumena. While a loose analogy could be drawn between this general strategy of Kant and that which Marvin detects in the Krishna Sangeeta, a more concrete parallel with Marvin's reading of the text, and one in fact suggested by Marvin himself, is found in the work of the American Unitarian Theodore Parker. Parker, who in fact acknowledged a significant debt to Kant, figured prominently in Bhadralok circles in Bengal in the latter part of the 19th century, a fact largely attributable to the discovery and dissemination of his works by Brahmos in the 1850s and 60s. Parker dealt in some depth with notions of the transient and permanent in Christian scripture, arguing that some scriptural elements may be regarded as permanent and essential, while others are accidental and subject to transformation. Marvin goes so far as to conjecture that Parker was a chief source of inspiration for the Krishna Sangeeta's Adunika Vad, and in so doing confirms the Bhadralok primacy inherent in his interpretation of the text. Despite its appeal to those who look to the Bhadralok habitus of Bhakti Vinod as theologically determinative, and though it is no doubt true that the works of Kant, Parker, and other such thinkers which together comprised what we might call the Bhadralok canon were naturally familiar to Bhakti Vinod, Marvin's construal of the Adunikavad, which forms the basis of his attempt to paint Bhaktivinoda's general project in a modern liberal theological hue, fails to adequately account for both inherent tensions within the text and significant revisions that he makes to a subsequent edition of the text. Let us now turn to briefly examine some instances of the latter. Bhaktivinoda first published the Krishna Sanghita in 1879. A revised version of the work appeared in installments throughout 1903 in Bhaktivinoda's Vaishnav periodical, Shadjan Toshini. Radhika Prasad, Bhaktivinoda's fifth child and manager of the Shadjan Toshini during this period, explains in his Bigyapan, or foreword to the second edition, that any changes to the text were made under the direction of Bhaktivinoda himself, a claim that would appear quite credible in view of the fact we know Bhaktivinoda was composing work up until 1907, and still re-editing many of his older works in 1904. This revised version of the work was published in book form as a full-fledged second edition in 1905. We learn from Bhaktivinoda's autobiography, Shalakita Jiboni, that there was in fact ample incentive for altering the text. Bhaktivinoda admits there to being dissatisfied with its initial reception, expressing that he felt readers had largely misconstrued the work. Quote, "Some said the book expounded a new theory. Some said it was good. A small number of educated youths said the book was good, but no one fully understood the essence of the work." End quote. The majority of the second edition's amendments appear in the Upakramanika, a clear indication that it was this section of the text that Bhaktivinoda felt had been most susceptible to misinterpretation. The first significant revisions that are found in the second edition of the text appear in an early paragraph wherein Bhaktivinoda briefly outlines the method and objective of the Upakramanika to trace the historical appearance and development of pure Vaishnav religion, Shuddha Vaishnav Dharma, in India. In the first edition of the text, Bhaktivinoda provides no indication that he does not genuinely advocate this approach, and one could not be faulted for assuming that the views he articulates in this section are indeed his own. He writes, quote, "After ascertaining the dates of the principal events of ancient India, I will establish the dates of all the respected books. Once the dates of all the books have been ascertained, I will reveal whatever can be obtained from them about the actual history of Vaishnav religion." End quote. Interspersed throughout the second edition, however, are distancing third-person phrases and demonstrative pronouns that Bhaktivinoda makes use of to disassociate himself from the narrative. He writes, quote, "After ascertaining the dates of the principal events of ancient India, according to modern consideration, I will establish the dates of all the respected books by that method. Once the dates of all the books have been ascertained, I will reveal whatever among them is clear about the history of Vaishnav religion, according to modern opinion." End quote. Furthermore, the second edition concludes this passage with an additional statement that cements this revised reading. Bhaktivinoda explains that his decision to adopt the Adunikavad has been based on contextual considerations. "We consider dates according to the ancient method, but we will have recourse to the modern method for the benefit of contemporary people." Turning next to what may have proved the most controversial passages of the Krishna Sanghita, those relating to the account of the Bhagavat Puran's genesis, we encounter Bhaktivinoda inserting phrases and statements into the text's second edition that perform this same distancing function. The first edition of the Adunika reconstruction of the traditional Bhagavat Puran Genesis narrative sees Bhaktivinoda proffer an alternative composer and date of appearance to tradition. Rather than ascribing the text to the legendary Krishna Dwaipayana Vyas, aka Veda Vyas, who the Bhagavat Puran itself claims conceived the text at the onset of Kali Yuga, he advances the notion of a more recent 9th century South Indian composer who used the pen name Vyas. As Bhaktivinoda explains, the appellation Vyas is to be understood as denoting all Vyases from Veda Vyas to the Vyas who composed the Bhagavat. While such a proposal would not have proved problematic for modernizing historical critical readers, the same cannot be said for orthodox Vaishnavas, who traditionally identify Vyas as an avatar of Vishnu. In the canonical Chaitanya Charitamrita, for example, Krishnadas Kaviraj, purporting to represent Chaitanya's own verdict on this matter, goes so far as to attribute the exalted status of the Bhagavat Puran within the Gaudiya tradition to its being revealed by Vyasa, self-same compiler of the Vedas and author of the Vedanta Sutra. Quote, if the maker of the sutras, i.e. the Vedanta sutras, himself explains them, then people can know their basic meaning. Travis Chilcott regards this equation as the tradition's hermeneutical linchpin for conferring upon the text special canonical authority. Vedavyasa's authorship of the Bhagavat Puran is thus by no means a nugatory detail in the context of traditional Gaudiya theology, and the first edition's ostensible display of receptiveness to an alternative account is likely to have raised more than a few eyebrows among orthodox sections of its audience. Unsurprisingly, then, the second edition sees Bhaktivinod make revisions to these passages, which again involve the use of distancing third-person phrases, such as, in the opinion of modern scholars, and they, i.e. the modern scholars, have concluded. We even encounter Bhaktivinod directly replacing first-person pronouns and phrases for their corresponding third-person forms. Though materially speaking, these are relatively minor changes, they have significant implications for our reading of the text. For example, whereas in the first edition, Bhaktivinod writes, in our opinion, the Bhagavat manifested in the Dravida region almost 1,000 years ago. The revised second edition reads, they say that the Bhagavat manifested in the Dravida region almost 1,000 years ago. Moreover, Bhaktivinoda again inserts a footnote into the second edition to clarify his own position vis-à-vis that which he expresses in the Upakramanika, going a step further this time, however, by unequivocally disavowing the Adunik narrative. We strongly disagree with this type of conclusion, that is, that Vedavyasa did not compose the Bhagavat. This type of faith cannot be considered genuine faith. Each of these revisions performs a virtually identical function, that of distancing Bhaktivinoda from the Upakramanika's historical critical reconstructive narrative. Though in many cases these amendments and additions appear minor or parenthetical, they are conspicuous by their incongruity with the progressive theologizing thrust and modernizing tone many detect in the Upakramanika, and when taken collectively are suggestive of a discernible shift in approach in the years that intervene between the publication of the first and second editions of the Krishna Sangita. Whether this movement is, to adopt a Ricurian idiom, a simple return to a primary naivete, or the transition through a critical moment to a second naivete, is a question that must for now remain unanswered. In either case, however, I suggest that it is a movement that certainly signals a turn toward a less compromising embrace of scripture and mythical narrative in the face of an encroaching 19th century historicism. End. Sorry.
Interesting. I feel like I know so little about this subject, so excuse me if my questions are really basic, but I'm not quite sure what's meant when you are talking about 19th century historicism and the trends that Vinod is subtly trying to undermine, I'm getting from his revisions. Mm. Could you just talk a bit more about that?
Well, I guess it's in a sense trying to really find or locate. Well, I don't know how to actually start. It's a broad subject. What is historical consciousness now? What is historical consciousness? I guess it's being aware of one's place in history and trying to understand. So this is a really bad definition, but the past in a more kind of exact scrutinizing way, in a sense, and particularly in light of or in the context of the development of the notion of a nation, in which the identity of a people is so much bound to their history, right? That this then starts to become seemingly a far more urgent matter than it well, at least appears to have been in the past. If you look at, you know, the notion of exact dates, etc., don't really feature, although there's tons of details and, like, there's really vast expanses of sort of time periods, like Satya Yuga being however many million years, the notion of actually trying to accurately chronologize everything, I guess, is what really starts to develop in that period.
I see.
Does that make sense? Does
yes. Okay. So what you're saying is there is a huge shift from what has been going on before in Bengal and what begins to happen in the 19th century, which is this chronologizing.
Sure.
But Vinod is in some way subtly undermining aspects of that through his revisions. Is that what's...
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Well, I would say that actually he seems to have been very much influenced by that, or addressing those concerns in the early part of his, you know, Vaishnav career, mm-hmm. as an author. But this second edition, 25 years later, during which time he's been intimately sort of integrating with and being transformed by devotional communities all around rural Bengal, mm-hmm. his whole notion of this changes, which seems to indicate that, like, not everyone had been influenced by this, this sort of new historical consciousness, if that makes sense. I didn't really draw on the community sort of aspect of in what I, because there's only limited time here, but really that's a key point that I'm making, that a lot of people have overlooked the fact that he's not just speaking to and moving within Vaishnav circle, Bhadralok circles, but that there is an existing community, a Vaishnav community that has been existing, but that seems to have been erased by this discourse of rupture, which speaks of, like, everything sort of being uprooted in the 19th century. Vaishnavism was, you know, on the decline, you know, wasn't really existent, which really I've been in the British Library recently and also in Bengal, but I was astounded to find that there's, like, throughout the 19th century, there's probably over, like, 400 titles, you know, by 19th century Vaishnav authors, which, of course, one could... This in itself would be an indication of there being some kind of rupture because of, you know, the proliferation of the printing press and this whole new publication culture. But I take it actually to be an indication of the opposite, that there must have been an existing Vaishnav community to be, you know, that they didn't all just become Vaishnavs and start reading Vaishnav theology overnight. Mm-hmm. To have written all this stuff, it would have been impossible, I think. That seems to be an indication of the fact that there was a thriving Vaishnav community throughout Bengal, throughout the 19th century, if not, and also before, I would suggest as well, that which doesn't fit in with the narrative of rupture.
I see. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry, I know I'm making a lot of comments. I just want to make, so there's, because I'm aware of two different approaches to this type of argument, challenging the dominance of colonialism. Mm-hmm. First is finding areas beyond the reach of the colonial influence, which is what we just talked about. And then the other is this idea of even changes that are happening are in some sense a continuity of trends that already mm-hmm. existed before.
Sure.
So are you focusing on both of those in your project? Or, like, have you found examples of kind of some sort of ideological root of this same type of historical consciousness in before the period of Vinod? Or is that not something that's...
Actually, it's a question that I haven't... I kind of left it open there, whether or not we can find traces of an early modern consciousness indigenously in Bengal. There is that debate. I might engage with it a bit more in my thesis, but I've left that open because what I'm focusing on is simply the persistence of something older into the modern period. And also this notion of rupture, I would say, here isn't purely, although I focused here on the post-colonial narrative that kind of propounds that, but it also seems to be somewhat ironically part of the nationalist and colonialist narratives as well, which trace the sort of golden age, you know, in ancient India, a decline in the Mughal period, and then again there was this sort of renaissance, a kind of a new invention of whatever it would have been in that. And that seems to have also filtered through into even insider narratives. There's this whole notion of Vaishnav decline, even within the tradition itself, but, like, the evidence seems to sort of suggest the opposite, actually. So there's three narratives I'm actually kind of that all seem to sort of unite in this idea of there having been a decline of some sort and a rupture. Okay. That it's not just the post-colonialists, although I do take issue with them. Yeah. Sorry.
Were you saying that the way that Vinod operates is that he starts off more historical and then
I think so.
Becomes a lot more, I guess, tradition based.
Yeah, tradition based. He starts off, being sort of making room much more for the historical critical, in the sense that he divides a text like the Bhagavad into its noumenal aspects, i.e. Krishna Lila, yeah? And everything else you can subject to reason. As Kant would say, you can do the phenomena.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah?
But how would he, when he talks about things in the Bhagavad that maybe, I guess, historical processes would find a bit more not so historical, like for certain miracles that would have happened in the Bhagavad,
well, not that he's saying that he's seeing those as historical, but he's saying that you can kind of demythologize those, mm-hmm, and try to find, which was actually a kind of tendency amongst Orientalists at the time, mm-hmm, like Wilson, William Jones, etc., that they did see some kind of like material for kind of working out a proper historical chronology in the Puranas, in other texts, particularly Wilson.
Because there were others later, right? Like Vivekananda, for example, he took issue with the fact that Bengali men were seen as effeminate. And so then when he talks about history, he imposes this the masculine, yeah, Aryan man when he talks about history. And then when there's other poets, for example, Bankim Chandra, when he talks about the Leelas, he talks about them with nationalist narrative.
Exactly. So that's a completely
earlier, but yours is obviously earlier.
Well, actually, no. He's a complete contemporary of. They went to the same school. He went to the same school, okay, as Bunkum in the same year. But and actually, Brian Marvin sort of undertakes a quite interesting comparison there, showing how they differ radically in their approaches to history, and that Bunkum's project is primarily. And I was being told this as well by Gautam Bhadra, who's one of the subalternists in Bengal. He kind of confirmed this, validated it for me, that Bunkim's project is primarily, it's like political theological, whereas Bhaktivinoda's is primarily social theological. Yeah, if not actually, I think at a certain point towards the end of his life, it's just entirely theological, mystical even, you could say. And that, and I kind of hinted at it at the end, where I go, you know, is this a primary naivety, which would be a kind of return to the literal acceptance of what the texts are saying, sort of taking them almost in the sense of those who maybe tore down, you know, the Babri Masjid mosque, you know, in 1992 in Ayodhya, as like literal history. Ram is born here, and therefore we're going to tear down this, I don't think there's any way, having been exposed to that critical current, you can return to a primary naivety, you know? I think in some sense it must be something more than just a literal acceptance of the Bhagavats again. And I think notions here of like scriptural reasoning that Gavin has spoken about in some of his books, kind of they come into play there. If that makes for instance, the importance of Vyasa historically, okay, fine, it may or may not have been Vyasadeva who composed, and it definitely wasn't historically, right? And maybe someone writing in the name of Vyasa. But theologically, as I made the point, it's absolutely essential, actually, to the Bhagavat's whole identity that Vyasadeva did write the Bhagavat, in the sense that it's seen and it styles itself as the natural commentary on the Vedanta Sutra, written by the author of the sutras themselves, Vedavyas. So theologically, it becomes important. So to understand their theological kind of reality, I think he's seen that there's really, you can't compromise on there theologically. Yeah, and actually history becomes, at a certain point, I would imagine, just that not a concern, because he's living within that spiritual reality, actually. Yeah, he's not. It's not about this world anymore. You understand? It's about absolute reality, which, and therefore, that Vyas did write the Bhagavatam has a spiritual reality to it, in a sense, if you know what I'm saying, if you follow the reasoning. Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense? Okay.
In that case, it's almost immaterial whether there was a kind of temporal rupture or not, because if he was always in this kind of ahistorical realm, mystical realm, whatever happens on the ground is, you know.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess in a sense, like, the question that I have to address in this is also, okay, fine, so there's indications of his, you know, persistence of tradition, but can't this itself be a tradition that he invented, you know, which would be, under the guise or under the name of tradition, a lot of modern things were created, right? So whether this is just another instance of an invented tradition or... And I think biographical and sort of social historical facts here kind of come into play that indicate that he was associating a lot with existing Vaishnav communities. Yeah. Wow, thank you. Sorry, so we went over a bit. Thanks. Yes.